Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadelsky. I'm my co-host, Dr. Carl Nadelsky Jr.
Yo, hey.
And we got an awesome guest today, Dr. Jesse Richards, head of obesity medicine down in Oklahoma, Tulsa. Has his own private practice, but also teaches residents and everything like that. So welcome, Dr. Jesse. We're going to be, this is actually both informative for those listening and also going to be a learning experience for me and my brother, because Dr. Jesse has a high prevalence of genetic obesity in his practice. And we were in these Facebook forums all the time hearing about his clinical experience. And I have a feeling that there are cases that I might see, but like we're going to kind of learn from him today about his experience with some of these big time genetics. And we're not talking about the polygenetic stuff that we've talked about on our podcast before. We're talking about monogenic and also syndromic obesity,
which we have touched on. So for anybody who needs the background, I think, you know, our Obesity as a Disease podcast and several others where we've talked about the genetics of obesity. We had a whole podcast on that. We definitely touched on these there, but
we're going to dive deeper.
What's fascinating to us is most of these rare genetic obesity disorders are pretty rare, or at least we thought they were.
We thought so.
And we now think, because we actually can look for them and we have some therapy that we're going to talk about for these very specific disorders, that it's probably it's under-recognized, but you happen to actually be catching a lot for some reason that you're going to talk about. While I've been doing a lot of genetic testing over the past couple of years since we had the availability, and none of my checks have like some heterozygous things like PCSK1 deficiency. Yeah. Haven't had any genetically confirmed vital that we're going to talk about.
Molecularly confirmed. Yeah.
But what we're interested in hopefully people out there is, you know, some of the clinical things, because not all genetic testing confirms that.
They're not going to find it.
Man, if you could call this stuff just from a single lab test, life would be so easy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, clinical gestalt actually still matters because this is one of those weird areas. So
that's important. And I think it's important that we raise awareness because of that, because we think it's probably, or at least some versions of all these things, is more common maybe than what we used to think.
This isn't taught on the boards, by the way.
It probably will be now.
So it's tested on boards.
But what you explain in the forums isn't the way the boards are. We know what these syndromes look like, but like, yeah, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. This is actually how I got into it. I've been really passionate about BC medicine since med school. And then this is one of the reasons that I really loved listening to one of the first podcasts was because, I kid you not, my attending and residency, and this was like 2016, accused me of being in the pocket of big GLP-1. We had no idea what the future was going to bring.
That was 2016. We were already knee deep in all the GLP-1s back then.
But she was like, well, you know, Victoza is not really any stronger than glipizide. And I was like, okay, slow your roll there. There was a lot of residents dragging attendings, and she was a wonderful attending and got on the bandwagon by the time I graduated residency. I'm not going to knock. If Dr. Reed, if you listen to this, please don't get mad at me. But it's staggering to look at the future and see where we're at with incretin-based therapies. Well, so I boarded in during COVID, and I still remember going like, oh, crap. You know, I'm internal medicine trained. I don't know this PED stuff. I didn't do an FM residency. I don't know about KITs. So I had to go back and memorize all of these genetic syndromes. And just like you guys said, I'm like, okay, this stuff is super rare. I am never going to see it. Well, as you do, you know, FDA announces all of these new drug approvals. And I still remember in December of 2020, I was like, what is going on? Pediatrics got two drugs in 1 month. This is unheard of, you know, because they got liraglutide for obesity and they also got setmelanotide. And I'm like, wow, okay. Well, I remember there's something about this on boards I'm studying for. Well, I'm never going to see it. Well, then a friend of mine works down in South Carolina, and she actually turned me on to the Uncovering Rare panel. Mm-hmm. And I specifically remember because I, at that point, I was doing primary care, and part of my time was in the obesity medicine clinic as our bariatric and metabolic program is growing. And then it's exploded. Like, we're up 500% a year. It's just insane, the volume now. But I remember I had this one patient, and you're going to hear this and it's going to click. He comes in 35 years old, BMI of 65, type 2 diabetes, A1C uncontrolled, bad heart failure, you know, mild kidney disease, you know, metabolic just mess. And I remember, you know, we get him on a GLP, we do a full direct medical therapy at him. He got a lot better and his BMI comes down into the 50s. And then one time he brought his son to the appointment. And I was like, wow, your kid's quite large. And he's like, oh yeah, not real names here. Like, yeah, Timmy, he's going to see the pediatrician about his weight. And I'm like, oh, that's great. You know, how's he doing? He goes, oh, he's down 20 pounds. And I was like, oh, wait. What did his weight start at? And he goes, oh, he started 180 pounds. I'm like, okay, down to 180, 160 in a pediatric patient. That's good. And I was like, oh, how old is he? Like 12? And he goes, oh no, he's 6. I was like,
wow.
Oh, okay. And that was the first exposure I had to this kind of multi-generational, something is grossly abnormal. And so then I was sitting there, I'm like, I need to get some kind of testing. Cause I ended up with half a dozen of these people and, you know, a large primary care panel, and it just was bugging me, but I could never get coverage. And then I found out about the Uncovering Rare program. So we started testing folks in our clinic, because we're the only clinic in the state that has medical and surgical interventions for Medicaid. So we're getting all of these like super rural, super sick, very high BMI, often very young. I mean, like, and that, like, it's like just a random Tuesday when I get a patient who's 19 years old and a BMI of 55. So like, we have this major referral bias. So, you know, like,
yeah,
we're an academic center, but we're one of the two centers in the state that we get this weird referral bias that comes in. And so I just start testing people, and, you know, the conditions are like pediatric obesity. So I start asking about that in my adult patients. I'm like, you know, hey, you know, do you struggle with weight growing up? You know, what was your weight in high school? And they'll be like, oh yeah, I'm 5'2" and my weight was 290 in high school. And I'm like, not subtle. That's not subtle. All right. Okay. And so then I start getting some of these test results back. And I remember, I think we had like 20 results back. And then I read this press release that was all of a sudden new indication for setmelanotide and Bardet-Biedl. And I'm like, oh man, I learned about Bardet-Biedl, but I don't have that. Well, then I go look and I'm like, crap, 9 of my patients have at least like one gene or had a couple, one or two of their compound heterozygotes. And I'm like, okay, well, I read about it. And I remember for boards, you had to memorize. It was autosomal recessive. I'm like, okay, well, they only have one copy of the gene.
Yeah.
But there's some of these like folks who are like really sick, like, they come in 450 pounds, you like put them on SEMA, they drop 100 pounds, they get bariatric surgery, they drop more weight, you put them back on SEMA. And I had one guy that I remember, he plateaued. And I mean, like, his life was changed. He was doing radically better. He plateaued on 2 milligrams of SEMA after a bypass at a comfortable BMI of 43.
Wow. Yeah.
And I was like, hey, he's got one of these genes that's associated with Bardet-Biedl. And so I'm like, well, I'm just going to go look up the clinical criteria. And so I go look it up and I'm like, oh, hey, wait, hypogonadism, chronic kidney disease, neurocognitive issues. Hey, did you ever have any learning deficits? And he's like, yeah, boss, I dropped out of school in 8th grade. I'm like, oh, he's like, I barely read. I'm like, okay. It's associated with diabetes. And he just check. And now he was not born with 11 fingers and toes. So, like, you know, that's not the pediatric, hallmark. But I was sitting there looking at this guy and I'm like, I've done everything I can do from a general obesity standpoint, you know, medically wise, because he had contraindications from other meds and we've done surgery. He's done phenomenal, but there is just something that is not right, you know? And I still remember he was the first patient that I was like, I think you have this. Mm-hmm. And so then when I talked to him and he just like slam dunked all of these major criteria. So the way I'm going to talk about BBS first and then we'll get back because
yeah.
I definitely agree. Like, the current approval for POMC, PCSK1, and leptin receptor, super, super narrow patients that are only homozygotes and coverage is very, very limited by and large. I think I have like one or two folks on for that. But BBS is one of the ones that it's more common. According to the initial estimates, there's around 2,000 to 5,000 people in the United States that may have it. And we know that based off of the lack of availability for genetic testing, that this is probably underdiagnosed. You know, it's like for a long time, we didn't have a treatment and the testing wasn't affordable or covered by insurance. And so it didn't really matter clinically if you made the diagnosis other than like, you should probably be sending them to a specialist to make sure the end organ manifestations aren't progressing. And so unless someone has an extremely severe case and ends up at like CHOP at the age of 5 with like 5 organ problems, you know, a lot of these folks just kind of float through the, especially the rural community.
Well, and because that's like you said, so the, you know, the term for that, but everyone's so different. Like there's just a lot of what we call heterogeneity amongst the, you know, of the,
yeah,
the clinical presentation. Some people like have the definitive, you know, like you said, the presentation, they have those things. And some people it's like real vague other than when we start thinking about these things, like you said, when you do a real weight history, yeah, stuff.
Well, Jesse sent us the screening paper, which you'll get into about like some may have polydactyly, which is extra digits,
right, hand, which is pretty
but
obvious.
Sometimes they have smaller digits, shorter digits, right, or syndactyly, or they're fused together.
So it's really amazing because, you know, you would think that people would know if they had 11 fingers or toes, but actually that's no. Certain like if it's just vestigial, like well, because yeah, you didn't use newborn nursery at some
point.
Yeah,
just put, like, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You tie off the little,
yeah, you tie it off.
Or the surgeon comes in and it's like, ah, there's no bones. We'll just, you know, take it off in clinic in a few.
So for people who are listening to this, tell them what that means.
Yeah, tell them all these different terms.
Okay. So let me go through it. Okay. So the hallmark symptom, then the one that you learn for obesity medicine boards is the post-axial polydactyly, which is an 11th finger or toe. Usually on the lateral aspect, although it can be anywhere. And I actually do not have a patient right now with clinical BBS in my clinic that has 11 fingers or toes. Now, I'm going to caveat that. I have a lot of their kids that do, and a lot of their parents that do. And I think we're up to like a dozen of their cousins that do. But my patients specifically did not have that issue. So Bardet-Biedl syndrome is a genetic ciliopathy. So anybody that's listening, when you think about ciliopathy, you think about like, you know, like weird renal disease or other stuff. And the major issue is that it affects cellular migration in utero. And so you end up with all of these really mild, odd malformations that may not actually like affect overall function that much, but they are abnormal. So you're absolutely right. The most severe version of the digits is the post-axial polydactyly, but much more common than that is like webbed fingers, which usually gets surgically corrected at 6 months, webbed toes, which is really considered cosmetic, so it's not usually addressed, and I see that pretty consistently. Or most commonly, brachydactyly, which can be a shortening of all of the digits, like just some selective digits, most commonly the fifth digit. And when you see these folks, like you walk in, you know, you walk in, you shake your hand, and then you just like look down, and they, because like BBS and a lot of these genetic syndromes associated with like abnormal height, usually short, but can be tall as well, you know, especially MC4R, traditionally very tall patients. but you just, you know, like you go in and shake their hand and you look and the fingers are just stubby compared to what you would expect based off the palm size. Mm-hmm. And then they, or they'll like walk in flip flops and sandals because it's warm outside and they have webbed toes. Same things can present there. So, okay. So that's fingers. Cognitive impairment is another thing that we see very commonly. So learning disabilities are one of the major criteria, overall cognitive impairment, developmental delay. These are things that, are a little bit harder to suss out in an adult, especially older patients. You know, if I have a teenager come in, I'm like, hey, were you on an IEP in school? Did you need help? Learning? Do you have dyslexia? Do you have dyscalculia? I see those a ton.
One thing I was reading, I don't want to interrupt you, but they yeah. talked about the visual differences, and that may, some of those visual issues may have actually manifested like people thought they were cognitively bad just because they couldn't see.
Yeah. So full disclosure, I kind of do a magic trick because when I walk in and the patient's wearing glasses, I'll just ask, I go like, you know, when between the age of 5 and 15, did you start wearing glasses? And they look at me like I'm like a voodoo person. And they're like about 7 to 9, because it's usually they get caught around that third grade because that's when they're doing all the pediatric vision testing for the milestones. And then school is checking their vision. And they just usually start to get blurry vision because it can manifest as astigmatism, farsightedness, nearsightedness, or reading difficulties. And you're right, that can mimic cognitive impairment. So the actual main long-term degeneration is a retinopathy, retinitis pigmentosum, or rod cone dystrophy is the kind of syndromic one. The major symptom from that is mild progressive vision loss, which can mimic age-related stuff, but it's mainly a low-light vision loss. So like in a normal, well-lighted room, outdoors during the day, people see fine. Maybe they need their glasses for whatever their, you know, minor correction is, but they do fine. But then when you ask them, well, how's your night vision? And they'll be like, oh, I do okay. And then you're like, okay, can you drive at night? And they're like, oh, no, I haven't driven at night in 10 years. Like, because they're their rods are malfunctioning, and anytime their rods are because they're weakened, are exposed to a bright light, it takes them minutes to reset. Mm. Now, this is one of those things that's a retina specialist diagnosis. So it is one of the ones that like to really nail it down is difficult. I'm fortunate that we have like 2 retina clinics 2 blocks from my clinic, and I have a lot of folks that are already following to get vision checked. But that like severe progressive loss of night vision is the most common thing. And actually I've had a couple of people that walk in, I'm like, do you have any vision issues? And they're like, oh yeah, I follow retina down the street for retinitis pigmentosa. I was diagnosed 15 years ago. And I'm like, thanks for walking in with the diagnostic criteria. That was really convenient of you.
But what about color blindness though, too?
Potentially color blindness. This is more of an issue in homozygotes. I don't see it as much in heterozygotes.
Can you explain it? I know people are probably like, you're throwing out terms there that are from medical school, heterozygotes versus homozygotes.
Sure.
Could you?
For sure. Okay. Flashback to Mendelian genetics. We have a number of genetic conditions in obesity that are autosomal dominant, meaning if you have one abnormal copy, the pathway is broken, it's not functioning properly. Bardet-Biedl is considered to be a autosomal recessive function, which is if you have one function, one that works properly and one that doesn't work, the one that works properly is still going to ensure signaling. Well, this was based off a lot of family studies that were done in the 90s by Beals and Forsyth and a number of other genetics-based investigators in pediatric populations that were predominantly Caucasian back before the Human Genome Project was done. Hmm. And the like, I've read a number of those papers, and the stuff that they were able to like go in and take these like crazy genetic histories and then work out and figure out where the genes were and this other stuff was amazing. But like when you look at the technology they were working with compared to the fact that I can like literally swab a patient's cheek and like 72 hours to 10 business days later have a comprehensive report back in my clinic. The future really is now. And so we know that ciliopathies really have more of a variable penetrance. And so there is this huge spectrum, because even back off the original family studies, they had patients that were homozygous pathogenic variants that did not present with the disease. Like they you'd have two siblings, one, two pathogenic variants, the other one, two pathogenic variants, one crippled with every end organ manifestation, the other one maybe gets one out of six.
So explain the penetrance. You just explained it, but like
that's kind of what we were talking about earlier, how not everyone gets the features, et cetera.
With variable penetrance, the genetics is the driver, but it's how your body manifests the results.
Yeah,
exactly. Your phenotype, it's a variable phenotype, even with the same genetics. And we have this in a lot of our like neurologic developmental issue, developmental diseases as well. And so you really can see every single one of these like main criteria. I see a whole spectrum of disease. Okay, so you know we touched on vision.
My brother has 100% penetrance for a Neanderthal.
Man, I was expecting a myostatin comment 5 minutes ago.
Yeah, no. Okay, he. Someone's been listening.
No, to I was going to make a joke about the polydactyly, and what about how's my brother? He's got a third leg though, so I don't know. I was going to make a joke. I was going to make a joke about that, but you're in such a good groove, so I'll make it now.
And I just got
for
fired
the
again.
40th, actually 63rd. I think this is 63rd.
So it's okay. You know, I can't compete with those. I'm just going to like, you know, get some black market bimagrumab in a couple of years.
Yeah, there you go.
You'll be fine.
Well, so, hey, so with the BBS though, you know, going back to those, we're talking about the genetics of Bardet-Biedl syndrome. The other thing about it that I think is, it's a little confusing to a lot of like clinicians, and certainly I'm sure would be confusing to people out there, is it's not like it's just one gene either.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of different associated genes. And even when we do the testing, and this is where maybe my questions from a more clinical perspective come into play, are we don't test for all of them. So there are patients who maybe meet the criteria who don't test positive because we don't even know all the genes. And there are some more advanced ways to check even deeper, but that's why these clinical things that you're talking about are important. Because so for people listening out there, if you or family members or friends, right, have some of these features, they should not be ignored. It's just that it's kind of a new science-ish.
Yeah.
And we happen to have therapy now. And so that's kind of what we're getting at.
And you're absolutely right, Casey. And like I said, this is an area where it was a kind of a learned helplessness before. And now that we have a therapy, we're going back to say like, hey, you know, we should be really carefully evaluating these folks. That vision, neurocognitive developmental,
the fingers and toes, the kidney stuff.
Kidneys. Just like with the others, there's a whole spectrum of kidney disease. In patients that present really young or really severe, they literally will be born with one atrophic kidney that is just a ball of cysts. And I have those.
Do those get? Are those caught early? You know, not often unless it incidentally.
So the answer is they usually have one functional kidney, and so unless something else triggers. Most common thing I actually see that that triggers medical intervention is recurrent urinary tract infection.
Okay.
Because this is really strongly associated with not just kidney, but anything that's kidney, if you're thinking about cellular migration, and you know, flashback to peds endocrinology, you know, we talk about each of those sections of cells and the reproductive and the genital urinary tract fusing. There's also a very high rate of ureteral abnormalities. And I see a lot of vesicular, VUR. I still can't say that word.
Reflux. Urinal reflux.
Yes. A lot of urinal reflux to the point where I think I probably have five or six patients that had to undergo pediatric urologic stenting at the age of like 3 to 5because of how bad it was. And I have others where they were like, usually if they're lower socioeconomic status and don't have peds urology around, they're like, oh yeah, I just got like 25 urinary tract infections between the age of 2 and 6. And I'm like,
you're like, that's not normal.
I was like, did anyone ever just tell you that's not normal? And they're like, well, my mom got it too. And the doctor just said our family was prone to that. And I'm like, that's not factually incorrect, but
right.
Wow. That's true. Okay. So, a lot of reflux, bladder abnormalities. I've seen duplicate ureteral systems. I've seen functionally normal, but it's kidneys that were anatomically abnormal because they never actually migrated and fused together. So it gets this like really external lumpy. So it's three completely separate lobes and never fused. And all of these are just like relatively benign variants. You also can see a mild but a progressive loss of kidney function. Like a lot of these patients that we see that are younger that have like unexplained proteinuria with obesity and all of a sudden there's other metabolic dysfunctions, it just gets chalked up to, oh, it was, you know, it was hypertension or it was the prediabetes or some other metabolic issue. And it turns out that there's probably actually this like genetic component that can drive that. So on these folks, really the easiest way to, this one's actually fairly easy to screen for because you can just check, you know, do they have a microalbumin? Do they have a normal kidney function? Do they, you can get a anatomy ultrasound. That's just a retroperitoneal ultrasound. That's completely non-invasive. It's pretty easy.
And I would suspect that some of these are almost incidentally found with imaging, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that seems.
I have folks that it's completely incidental. They'll be like, oh yeah, they said I had like 17 cysts in this one kidney, but my function's fine. So I said, don't worry about it. And I'm like, yep. Because this is not the polycystic, like, you know, hundreds of cysts. Mm-hmm. This is like right. A number of cysts, or like it's all, again, it's all a spectrum. So then overlapping, because again, it's adjacent, but not the same because it's a separate criteria. There is a hypogonadism component that's involved in this. Traditionally, this is specifically associated with males. It is not a like 100% infertility. So it's not like, you know, there's something anatomically missing, but it's associated.
And it's a primary meaning testicular failure. Do you know? I don't remember.
The answer is it depends. I see a lot of what looks like either primary, like hypogonadism, testicular failure, or also potentially some hypothalamic. I am not an endo, so like I will do the workup to diagnose if I have men that are coming in with symptoms or that we're screening for. And you know, again, you guys talked with Alex, and so like I see actually a number of folks that have like completely functional eugonadal, pseudo hypogonadism and obesity that don't really fit. But then I also see patients where it's like, well, your total testosterone was 52, and your free was 3. That's not that difficult to make the diagnosis.
Also, for those out there, we also have an episode on do you have low testosterone, where we talk about primary, yeah, which means it's your testicles that have failed, versus central or secondary, where it means there's a problem up in your hypothalamus pituitary area, which can range from damage to tumors to genetic causes, by the way. And that's where we get into some of these things.
Well, okay, pathophysiology. Hyperphagia, mm-hmm, meaning excessive.
Well, so that's the feature we haven't gotten to, which is the key of what we're talking about.
That is the elephant in the room. Almost there.
When we're doing a weight history, what we all do, and what we want patients and those out there to think about are, you know, when people were born, what then happened? You know, was there excessive, you know, hunger, lack of satiety, what we call insatiable hunger as little kids, and significant obesity, early onset obesity. And so that's a real key thing that I think most of us do that we need to raise awareness of for sure amongst patients and, you know, primary care docs and everyone out there too.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. And this is one of those things where history really helps guide. I mean, now, hyperphagia is one of the cardinal symptoms. It is possible to have all of the other manifestations and have BBS syndromes without it, but it is the major one that we most commonly see. And it's the one that setmelanotide like most directly normalizes. And so that's one of the ones that we really hone in on. So I agree. Weight history. And so I only deal with adults. If I can get pediatric records, that's great. But if I can't, really, I start with where they're at and then kind of, you know, work back. So say they're coming in 35 or 40 and go, hey, you know, where was your weight when you were 16 to 18 years old? Because not all these people did high school. Because I asked high school and they're like, well, I didn't do high school. I'm like, okay, rephrase. And then I'll get an answer. And then because central adiposity is actually one of those like big overlaps with the obesity diagnosis as a core feature of this disease, I will actually follow that up with a question specifically asking about like body morphology when they were younger. And I go, okay, if you're female, like, well, what size jeans were you in high school? And they'll be like, oh, I was 16 to 18. women's at the age of 13. And I'm like, that is a lot of central adiposity. Or for guys, you know, because guys don't keep track of pants the same way, let's be honest.
Other than, you know, there was that episode of Seinfeld where he changed the size, you know, and then his girlfriend dumped him because she thought that was offensive.
Ridiculous.
So then for guys, I'll ask like, what size t-shirt are you in? Cause you know, that gets the whole like truncal gut chest obesity. And they'll be like, oh, you know, I was in like a 3XL in eighth grade. And I'm like, there it is.
But their birth weight was normal.
So the birth weight's normally normal. And so then the working back from there, when I hear something like that, I go, okay, obviously you had obesity going on in middle to high school. And then I literally, the easiest question to just ask them, because people remember the bias. I go, how old were you when you noticed you were bigger than other kids? And they will instantly tell you, oh, it was first grade, kindergarten. Yep. I literally don't ever remember being the same size as other kids from age 4, my first memories. And I'm like, that's terrible. I'm so sorry.
In my practice, you know, those are the ones that get tested kind of no matter what, not necessarily just for Bardet-Biedl. When we talk about genetic testing for, you know, early onset, severe genetic syndromic obesities, those are kind of the keys.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I just want to say this because this was interesting. Were you at Obesity Week this last year?
I was.
Jesse?
Yeah.
Spencer missed this lecture. So, you know, we got there, we just went for Spencer's talk on the debate on exercise stuff. But I got there a little bit early and I got to see a really nice talk by Faruqi, who's the global leader in obesity genetics.
Mm-hmm.
And she and others, they were talking about how, you know, we've learned so much these days and how once upon a time, and we all think, you know, we probably all know this, but once upon a time and probably still, little bitty kids who have significant obesity are being referred to, child protective services.
Yep.
Because it's almost considered child abuse, but it's not. How often do you think this has happened? But it's not the parents' fault, because their children have some sort of strong genetic driver of hyperphagia and they can't stop eating. And yet, you know what I mean? And how sad is that, that we've probably missed some of these genetic causes all these years. Mm. And it's maybe potentially ruined lives, family lives. I mean, I hadn't really thought about that and it broke my heart. I was like, oh my God.
Yeah. And this is one of those things, again, I'm not peds, but setmelanotide in these either genetic syndrome or in the rare homozygous monogenic obesity is actually approved down to age 6. And so this is one of those things where I think early identification, or in my case, late identification of a parent who then can, once they realize that they have something going on, look over at their kid and go, you know, they're struggling with the same thing I am, and get them help early.
Yeah.
It can, I think, be life-changing.
What is it about BBS that affects hyperphagia? Because, you know, we got POMC. It's clearly, that's one of the pathways we always talk about. We talk about leptin receptors.
So we may want to review the whole pathway a second. You know what I mean? Just quickly, I don't know if you want to do that or you want us to do it. And because we've done it for the audience before, the whole, you know, the energy balance system of our brain controlling our weight and our appetite and our metabolism. Because it's in that POMC neuron, the hypothalamus that we're going to talk about.
So for POMC, which is the most distal step in the melanocortin 4 pathway, right before, because it releases the alpha MSH to go agonize on MC4R, which MC4R agonism is the mechanism of action of setmelanotide. So it skips the whole process and hits the final step. So POMC was the first one that was studied, because they said, you know, we have a drug that hits here. Let's look at the people that the previous step is knocked out. Then they went back up the pathway. They looked at PCSK1 because it conducts the signal. Then they looked at leptin receptor specifically for patients that have genetic mutations in leptin receptor, because they go, if you don't have the receptor, you can't receive peripheral to central leptin signaling. Makes sense. Bardet-Biedl is the step after that, because again, we said that this is part of ciliopathy. Well, cilia are involved in a lot more than just like beautiful images of cells on a plate wiggling around. They're actually involved in intracellular and extracellular transport, which is very important when you're trying to conduct afferent to efferent signals through neurons.
I mean, so for the people listening out there, you know, the basic pathway that we're talking about is your fat cells make leptin, which is, you know, a very famous hormone that was discovered, you know, several years ago. That's very important for signaling to the brain about our current energy balance situation. So leptin's supposed to go up to the hypothalamus, where we have these, what we call POMC, that's what we're going to call them for now, neurons. And then it signals those. And then it sends a hormone called alpha-melanocyte stimulating hormone up to a second order neuron called the melanocortin 4 receptor. And that's what improves or, you know, works on appetite, satiety, et cetera, and also metabolism.
Energy expenditure, yeah.
And so that whole circuit is critical for our whole appetite, metabolism balance and our adipose centers. But that POMC neuron where the leptin goes and tells it to say, hey, we have enough fat tissue or we've eaten enough or whatever, there's all these different other little things in there. There are a few that are very specific genetic disorders that are rare that, you know, maybe we'll do another episode on that. But then there's this, what we're talking about is aspartate vital. And that's what you're talking about, the cilia, and it just doesn't work. Basically that
BBS hits before that system. Okay. So you did send us a paper on a case report of a GLP-1 agonist. So GLP-1 agonists, yeah. There are receptors in the hypothalamus above,
yes,
that. So it should hypothetically work. Right.
So the answer to that is yes, it's great to treat hyperphagia in some people.
But it doesn't.
Because just like you have a spectrum, yeah, of all of those end organ manifestations, there's a spectrum of hyperphagia. Because I have folks that come in and the question I ask is, do you feel full? And the answer is either yes, which point I'm like, oh, that's great. That's very reassuring. No. Okay. That's really easy. Or I get a blank deer in the headlights look because they literally don't understand what that means.
Right. They've never been satiated. They've never been satisfied,
yes,
or satisfied in their life. Or like Dad would say, Harry Hachibu.
So
just.
So, okay. Now, that being said, GLPs and then, you know, obviously topiramate, I don't know actually if this has come up with you guys, like there's actually interesting evidence that topiramate through the non-selective carbonic anhydrase inhibition can upregulate endogenous GLP-1 production in response to nutrients. And so that's one of the really old upstream mechanisms for increased craving reduction with topiramate. That can help blunt some of this. And I have some people that do absolutely phenomenal on SEMA. Or especially tirzepatide. But it does not work for everyone. And it seems to depend on how severe the knockout is. And then obviously, if folks have one genetic thing that's wrong, that doesn't preclude them from having other genetics that are wrong. Like,
yeah,
I think the average in our clinic, we've tested probably like 450 patients on the Uncovering Rare panel with an 80% positivity rate is like 2 points.
That's extremely high.
Well, and you're going to have to fill everyone in on that part of it later, but let's conclude this pathophysiology and why we're talking about this medicine called setmelanotide.
The answer is, it depends on how bad the breakdown in the MC4R pathway is. If they have residual signaling so they can get full, they just get hungry again really soon, GLPs augment the heck out of that. Works great. But if they just don't ever feel full, I nicknamed it like GLP-1 rebound, because they will eat, they will actually experience a sense of fullness, maybe for the first time in their life, and then 30 minutes later, they're hungry again. Mm. And they might still lose weight, because compared to never feeling full, like,
right,
being full for 30 minutes is really a reprieve for them. But then they get hungry like 30 minutes to an hour later. And I'm sure you guys have had dozens of patients just like I do that they're like, yeah, I don't get full for a week on semaglutide.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Okay. So for anybody listening, the setmelanotide, it actually skips a lot of this pathway and gets right at the source, right at this thing called the MC4 receptor. So you don't even have to go down below at the POMC.
Right. Where all those other medications we've talked a lot about essentially work up in different receptors of that POMC neuron that really starts the cascade. So GLP-1 receptor agonists, phenermine, topiramate, naltrexone, bupropion, essentially, for all intents and purposes.
Here's a good question. then why don't we give setmelanotide? Let's skip GLP-1s. Let's give setmelanotide to everybody for just.
Yeah. So we haven't even talked about the medicine yet that helps skip this. And that's a very good question.
I feel like we've covered most of the syndromic stuff.
Yeah, we have. I think everybody's got the gist.
So it would probably work maybe-ish. Setmelanotide, I don't know about you. I deal with a lot of Medicaid patients. Maybe you guys have patients, but it's a cool.
I have a lot of Medicaid. Yeah.
Okay. Maybe Spencer has some patients that could afford it. It's a cool $30,000 a month.
$30,000.
Yeah. Maybe Spencer could afford it.
It literally no. makes Ozempic look like Phentermine cheap, because it's a genetic replacement therapy. It's actually been reclassified by the FDA as a genetic replacement therapy because of the missing protein signaling. So, what it does is it really, if they have hyperphagia, it just normalizes it. And it's amazing because these people come in and I have just like example after example of come in, 8 dietitian visits, see me 5 times, get on 5 of the traditional, you know, old school AOMs, or maybe even on like, you know, an early GLP, if we can swing coverage, gain 20 pounds in a year. And you're like, and the surgeon's like, I don't want to operate if they're consistently in an upward trend because I'm worried that like if this isn't controlled, it's going to affect post-op stuff. You put them on Imcivree, and I had a patient that she was gaining weight 5 pounds a month on Phentermine 15 and Topiramate 50, and put her on setmelanotide, and she came back 2 weeks later and had dropped 14 pounds. And she literally cried to my nurse because she was like, I didn't know that this was what feeling full was like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is what we hear a lot, just in general, what we call polygenic obesity, from a lot of patients who have just struggled their whole lives, just in general, when we get them on semaglutide, tirzepatide, et cetera. But the patients we're talking about today and in those other rare genetic disorders, they don't feel that way on those medications. Nope. They feel it on this one that skips over the dysfunction.
So in common obesity, though, it's not a very set dysfunction, like specifically in one spot in the brain. So I have a feeling that you obviously setmelanotide is a very specific receptor for very specific diseases. Whereas common obesity, there's probably other dysregulation in the brain that the GLP-1s likely help with, the reward system and other components.
Yeah,
so I think that's kind of what I was getting at. And obviously, I think there's also side effects from setmelanotide.
There are different side effects and it's costly.
When you look at the side effect profile on topiramate, it's kind of horrifying. But setmelanotide, so when you compare it to that, like it's not really that much worse than some other stuff we use, but there are definitely side effects. The number one is hyperpigmentation. Mm-hmm. And this will freak patients out if they are not properly educated on it. Basically,
so explain why, because it'll make sense if people look into the hypothalamus and these different hormones.
The receptor that we're talking about that's broken, that downstream from POMC, is a melanocortin 4 receptor. Now, setmelanotide is a relatively specific melanocortin 4, but it also hits melanocortin 1, which is what causes your skin to release melanin or pigment. So
your melanocytes.
Melanocytes get stimulated by this. Now, there is a theoretical risk of concern. There's never been any cancer signal in anything of these trials that have been going on for 10 years. They're monitoring for long term. I just wanted to put that disclaimer out there. It's not the same as getting shot up with UV rays. But there is a significant increase in pigmentation. It depends on the baseline level of melanin production. So I have a lot of patients that don't get outdoors and are very, very, very pale. And so for them, their skin turns 2 shades darker and it's still well within the normal range. But I have a lot of folks, then there's variability in this response, just like there's variability in everything else. I have folks that I had someone complaining because she did not have any response from a skin perspective. And then I had a patient that came back and her skin was 5 shades darker and she ended up deciding to discontinue the medication. This also seems to make folks, because of that baseline stimulation, more sensitive to sun exposure. I have a lot of folks that come in and it's basically like a farmer's tan on steroids. And so I tell everybody to make sure you wear sunscreen. That's not officially on the label, but I've seen it enough at this point that we recommend it.
Have you guys heard of Vileci? Bremelanotide?
So, yes, actually I have. And Vileci has 2 phase 1A human prospective trials of once a day or twice a day dosing. The molecule is called bremelanotide. where they actually showed generalized weight loss and a reduction of, I think it was about 490 calories a day in a metabolic ward over a 2 week setting.
That's pretty amazing. So, Casey, you know what that is? You might see sexual dysfunction. Well, it's they're calling it female Viagra.
Yeah, but that one hasn't been. Is that the one that was?
It's made
just
for sexual dysfunction, MC1 and MC4 non-specific receptor agonists.
Yeah, no, I think I shared. Was it just approved?
Relatively.
It was approved in 2020
for sexual dysfunction. Because I shared it because I was like, this is something that people should know about, but I have not.
So
used it or engaged in it yet.
I stumbled across that drug because I was trying to learn more about setmelanotide, and I Googled MC4R brain MRI and it studied on bremelanotide came up, and I went, what the heck is bremelanotide? I've never heard of this drug. Well, it turns out my wife's OB-GYN in the same academic group. Every time I walk over to her, I walk past a poster for that drug and I just never knew. And if you go on Lexicomp and you look at the side effect profile for the two,
it's weight loss.
They're identical. Every single
side effect that's what
is
I was,
exactly the same.
Because I was just learning about it. I was like, what? This is like the same thing. But women can get it for much cheaper. I assume it's not as effective necessarily.
It's basically $100 cash for a pack of four auto injectors. So like four doses of the medication or 4 days of the medication is $100.
Okay.
So,
that's interesting.
And
we'll see what happens there.
I know there's definitely a lot of, I'm sure there's probably some off-label use. I may be talking to them about possible trial.
I wonder how much trouble I'm going to get in if I make any specific comments about
it. Yeah, I wouldn't make any comments.
Nope. I will say though that
I already got trouble.
You just got fired.
There does seem to be some weight loss related to bremelanotide. And so there may be a general weight loss as well. But in the context of the monogenic and syndromic obesity, who have a specific dysfunction in the MC4R pathway, it's a radical improvement.
Do you see libido improvements with setmelanotide? Because that's so the women, I see it on TikTok, they like rave. They're like, I took the Vyleesi, and they don't say specifics. They just go, it works. And
so
I'm just like,
actually, one of the, so the hyperpigmentation is the most common. Actually, I counsel every single patient on increased libido. Technically, this in the IMCIVRI trial, there were four teenage boys between the age of 14 and 21 who experienced one spontaneous erection over a 12-week period.
Hmm.
Now, that being said, in clinical real-world use, I have a lot of patients that come back and who tend to be about 35 to 50-year-old females who go, I might be in the mood more, but I think it's just because I feel better and I just, everything is overall going better. I would say I definitely have noticed some increased libido, nothing that would be uncomfortable or concerning from a tolerance or discontinuation perspective. Does that make sense?
I guess I'd have to talk to somebody to understand how the MC1 and MC4 regulate sexual function, libido in the first place for women specifically. I haven't looked much into it.
Well, the last thing we need is for you to take an injection.
All right.
I see you just did that. I see you just ordered some and just injected it. It just came on one of those
Amazon little, the drone came
Amazon
in.
Just the drone came and
dropped
just
it right
injected
on
it right into Spencer.
Just get me off this podcast.
The other big thing that's really interesting with this in the actual clinical treatment is that we see these crazy body composition changes even outside of scale changes. I had a patient come in last week. This is anecdotes. I sent you the body composition changes in leptin receptor, which actually showed like lean mass was stable while weight was going down pretty significantly over, I think it was a 12 to 24 month period. Which is very, very reassuring because one of the things we always worry about with AOMs is decreased lean mass. And so I had a patient come in, had been on medication, I think 10 weeks, and dropped from a jean size 18 to 14 with no physical activity and only lost 2 pounds. Which is, and when you think about it, this genetic dysfunction is causing the signaling impairment. And they are predisposed to severe central adiposity. So I don't think it's necessarily that the drug just like strips adipose off. I think it helps renormalize what their body would have been holding at baseline.
Yeah, there's a partitioning effect there.
Exactly.
Seems to be. Yeah. Because why would it be central as opposed to everywhere?
Yeah.
Global.
Yeah.
Central means, so if anybody listening, partitioning effect is where you would store muscle or fat. And in this case, in BBS, there's some, for some reason, a central storing of adipose, as opposed to other people, they just have a lot of adipose everywhere, legs, hips, and abdomen and arms. So for some reason, this syndrome, and I don't know, there must be some partition. It must be the ciliary effect of something. I have no idea. I'm not sure. You might know better.
Well, Casey, if you want to weigh in, but like, I think it's one of the things is the downstream effect of leptin is actually modifying the CNS to peripheral adipose sympathetic tone and is affecting some of that like brown adipose recruitment and metabolic.
Might be the hypogonadism as well, I suppose, if the if that's the case, which can have a big effect on it, there's probably a ton of things that could contribute to it.
Right.
So
a lot of different aspects.
Seriously, this has been informative. We're basically up in the hour. We don't usually go this long. It's like I personally want to figure this out because I do all telemedicine, and so I think I'm going to have to come up with screeners. I'm trying not, you know, we don't want to screen everybody, but I think
if I can tease,
we have
a submission into TOS that I'm very hopeful it gets accepted that gives everyone the standardized screening that we implemented in our clinic to get a 80% positivity rate on uncovered.
That's amazing. And I can't wait. I'm going to wait for that.
I want to specify, when I say 80% positivity, I mean that we came back with an abnormal variant of uncertain, likely pathogenic, and that's heterozygotes or homozygotes. So that's not just people that come back with, you know, pathogenic genes. That's more in like 5% of patients.
You know, that reminds me. I wanted to ask you about your specific geography and perhaps that selection bias because you know, we test a lot of people based upon that history, right? It's very important that if people out there have the early onset obesity, any of these features or any, you know, just anything that seems off, especially from childhood, that the pediatricians and you know, the adult doctors like us, that we're aware of it so we can consider this genetic testing. So we test a lot, but we haven't gotten that much. You definitely have a higher positivity rate. So tell people about that and why it's not just going to be everywhere.
So I want to say that while we have a standardized workflow, like literally my nurse walked in yesterday and she was like, positive screen, here's her major and minor criteria, but I have an outstanding nurse. We live kind of in the buckle of the obesity belt. I'm in Eastern Oklahoma, which is not that far from Western Arkansas, Louisiana, Western Mississippi. And we have a very, very large, very rural, high consanguinity, which just means basically you're part of a relatively small gene pool because you were separated from other folks. We have a very large Native American population. We actually work with several of the tribes pretty closely. And there's also like a lot of like just segregated communities, Amish, Mennonite, things like that, that have been relatively closed off. And when you think about it, you know, where were a lot of these original genes actually came up? Well, actually, one of the original BBS studies was in a founder effect in an Amish population. And some of the other monogenic obesity stuff was in the Ashkenazi Jewish population because they have a higher rate of this as well. And you see it, you know, all over. Anytime that there's like an island, anytime that there is just a closed off segment where people don't have as much intermingling, these genes can propagate down and get carried forward. So with that in our specific referral bias, I think that really increases the rate, like the baseline of our clinic. But I do think that just by catching these historical things, which really sounds like you guys are already pretty much clued into, that can help guide who is an appropriate patient for screening testing.
I love it. You better let us know when that's awesome. Out because I am going to incorporate this into telemedicine or telemedicine
practice. Absolutely.
Yeah. And for patients, I just want to reiterate, for people out there listening, you know, if you or your family or friends have some history that suggests that something was off from an early age, you know, extreme hunger, insatiable hunger, other abnormalities, you know, from mental issues, you know, learning deficits to, you know, extra fingers or whatever, to also primary care docs. I want to hopefully work with my pediatricians in the Holland Hospital system and all the family docs and make sure that there's an awareness. I think the first step is we got to raise awareness, and because it's important that we dig deeper and help these people and not just let them fall through the cracks.
Yeah. Thanks. Thank you, Jesse, for coming on.
Absolutely. Guys, this has been an absolute blast. If I can show one thing before I leave.
Yeah.
Yes, please.
Okay. I don't know, who made that decision, but if you want to hear somebody ramble about this for an hour with a bunch of PowerPoint slides and very complicated feedback diagrams, I will be doing that at one of the keynote lectures at TOS this fall.
Nice.
Oh, really? You're going to be at Dallas?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if I'll be able to, I might be able to make it for the weekend or something.
Come on. You know, you want to.
Let's just go.
I got to give a talk the weekend before in Maryland or something. And anyways, yeah, we'll see.
Awesome.
I'm part of the steering committee. I think I got you on to speak probably.
That's great.
I helped develop the program.
That's great. Thank you so much for coming on. We'll probably have you on again. If anybody, share this, give us a good review on wherever you're listening to this. And if you're in Oklahoma, you want an obesity doctor, Dr. Jesse Richards is the guy.
My wait list is about to explode.
All right. Yeah, don't go. Okay, just come to us at Sequence, I guess, whatever. All right. Unless you have genetic stuff. All right. Anyway, thanks for listening.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll be right back.